I'm back. I told you I'd be back. Promised I would do a little bit of research. I promised that I would listen to podcasts and read articles and try to find out what was about the secret history that I didn't get, why everybody else likes this book so much and is devoted to it, why it's got this cult following, and somehow or other I missed the boat. And I got to tell you, what I found out was it's either one of two situations. One, I'm really, really dumb and I just didn't get it. Or two, there's a whole bunch of posers out there. And, you know, I said I was going to do a whole bunch of research. And frankly, I got through about four or five articles and one podcast, and I'd pretty much had enough because they all said the same thing. And they were all just really starting to piss me off. So I really didn't want to do any more research, read any more, listen any more about all the ways that The Secret History was such a brilliant book and how it's touched so many lives and why so many people reread it constantly. I just got tired of it. So I stopped. I promise I went in with an open mind. I really tried to figure out what it was that I missed. I really was open to the idea that perhaps there were things about the book that didn't resonate with me that may have resonated with other people. I tried. And you know what? It just didn't succeed. Now, there was one thing about the research that I did that actually made me feel somewhat good about myself. If you recall that I made mention of the fact that the second half of the book is really a devolving of the characters as they pretty much go through the trauma of trying to keep the secret of the murder of their classmate Bunny and how they tend to fail to really rely on each other. There's a significant level of distrust amongst the five of them, five or six, I don't really remember at this point. And there's also pretty much experiences that all the characters have with every particular vice that was available. And I think that I made mention of the fact that it struck me as being very similar to the book of the early 80s called Less Than Zero. Now, what we didn't discuss is that Less Than Zero was a book written by Bret Easton Ellis. And Bret Easton Ellis, as many of you know, is much more noteworthy for his introduction to the world of the character of Patrick Bateman and the book American Psycho. But what I found out from listening to one of these podcasts and by reading these articles is that the author of The Secret History, Donna Tartt, and the author of Less Than Zero, Bret Easton Ellis, were classmates together. They were really good friends. And in fact, the podcast that I listened to even discussed Bret Easton Ellis as being a huge influence on Donna Tartt. Now, it didn't mention Less Than Zero. It mentioned another book by Bret Easton Ellis called The Rules of Attraction, which you may recall within the last 10 years or so was made into a movie starring, I think, James Vanderbeek. And they apparently discussed, they discussed in the podcast that apparently Rules of Attraction is a very similar book to Secret History. It takes place on a college campus. There's rampant sex and drug use and alcohol, et cetera, et cetera. But when I heard the comparisons of The Secret History to a Bret Easton Ellis novel, and I had certainly thought that it was akin to Less Than Zero, not having read Less Than Zero, not having seen the movie, not having read Rules of Attraction, not having seen the movie, I felt a little bit good about myself that of this whole entire world of potential influences, I found the author to whom this particular author, Donna Tartt, was closely aligned with. And apparently, there's even more similarities between The Secret History and Rules of Attraction than just the drug use and alcoholism and the fact that it takes place on a college campus, that even the names of the universities are fairly similar and even names of characters and things like that. So I felt a little bit good about that, felt a little bit justified in some of my comments from that respect, but other than that, it pretty much ended there. Now, I did listen to a podcast. The podcast is called Adventures with Words, and it's a British podcast with a man and a woman. And despite the fact that they have very lovely accents and it's an enticing language to listen to, it always sounds so proper and prim and educated, they did nothing to convince me that the way I perceived The Secret History was incorrect and that their perception of it was accurate. What was interesting is that the male host of the show mentioned that he had first read The Secret History when he was in college, and that it was actually the selected text that was to be read by one of his English literature courses, or one of his literature courses. And so he had the opportunity to read The Secret History much the same way that the main characters of Secret History studied their Greek literature and Greek philosophy and Greek history together. It was a very small group of students in this one class sitting around a room in their lazy chairs, basically, the lazy boys, reading The Secret History together and talking about it. And he felt a close relationship or connection to the characters in The Secret History because he was experiencing that same sort of connection with the his fellow classmates in this class. But he went to school in like outside St. Louis or some Midwest school. He had come over here from England to go to school. He didn't go to school in a upstate, you know, Vermont, East Coast, hotty-totty type of a school. And even though he talked a good game, he and his co-host talked this great game about how much they enjoyed the book, they didn't really discuss any pertinent details as to what it was that resonated with them. And one of the things that he focused on as being a basis for why he really enjoyed the book was this concept that the main character, Richard, was an unreliable narrator, and how he had reread the book a second time in preparation for this most recent podcast that they recorded. And as he was reading it, he was noticing that he had made notations in the margins of the book the first time he'd read it, and he was pointing out instances during the book in which Richard was telling the reader a lie. And he would say, he's lying here, he's lying here, he's lying here. In some situations, Richard came right out and said, this was a lie, or, that wasn't exactly the truth, or whatever it was. So the reader tells you that he is, at different points in the story, telling you a lie. But the host of this podcast was talking about how this unreliable narrator, Richard, was such a fascinating aspect of the book, and how that really made the book so much more impactful for him. And the whole time I'm listening to this podcast, and he's talking about how this Richard is unreliable and such the constant liar, the question that came uttering out of my mouth, and each time the host would talk about how fascinating it was, I would yell louder and louder and louder these words. To what end? What was the point? We've read books, you and I, we've all read books, we've talked about books on this podcast that have first-person accounts from unreliable narrators. I talked about the S.J. Bolton book, Now You See Me, and I talked about The Likeness, and I've talked about all these other books that I've read where you have these unreliable narrators. And the benefit of having an unreliable narrator is at the end of the book, there's a reveal. There's something that the unreliable narrator tells you where he will bring it all, or he will bring it all back together and basically tell you that all along they've been lying to you. And not only that, that it changes the whole story. It changes everything. And I remember when I read Drood by Dan Simmons, which involved Charles Dickens and Wilkie Collins, and whether the writing of The Mystery of Edwin Drood by Charles Dickens wasn't really a writing of a true story. And it's this fictionalized account, obviously. But I remember when I finished the book, and it was narrated by Wilkie Collins, he told us something. And I don't remember exactly what it was, but as soon as he said it, I closed the book, looked at the cover, and said, you have been messing with me this whole time, 600 plus pages, and it's a very large book. You've been messing with me. Everything that I've read, I now have to reconsider, is not true. You've been lying to me. Everything about this has been lies. And that is a true benefit of an unreliable narrator, is it gives you the opportunity to have perspective on the entire book, so you go back and rethink everything that happened and try and determine what was true and what was false. But in The Secret History, he's an unreliable narrator. According to the host of this podcast, he tells you he's an unreliable narrator, but at the end of the day, there's no reveal. There's no aha. There's nothing that says, and this is why I've been lying to you all along. I've been lying to you all along because this. Richard never tells us that. So you go through the whole book wondering if he's telling you the truth, and at the end of the book, you don't know, and you're unsure, and it doesn't provide you with any resolution. I read one article, And it was written in February of this year, and it says, why does Donna Tartt's The Secret History inspire such devotion? And the author of this article, and I'm not going to name names because I don't want to call people out, But whoever this person is, a woman, she says, I first read The Secret History the autumn before I turned 15. Even then, I understood that this was the perfect age for it. 15? The book, the first half of the book at least, involves Greek mythology, Greek philosophy, the classics, the study of the Greek language, and this thing called a bacchanal, which is basically a Greek tradition that involves some sort of a social orgy. And you mean this woman means to tell me that at 15 years old she identified with the book? I don't buy it. I don't buy it. This, to me, is the person who's the poser in junior high, who wants to read the big books because she thinks it'll make her look intellectual. I'm not sitting there reading, you know, Charles Dickens in class. I mean, we have to read that, but I'm going to read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance because it's going to show that I know so much more about existentialism and about, you know, the world of Zen, and I'm going to read The Tao of Pooh, and I'm going to read... Really? You know, I saw people like that when I was in junior high and high school, and I always considered myself a good reader, and I looked at those people and I went, you guys are posers. You don't really understand this stuff. And she means to tell me that at 15 years old, she understood that it was a perfect age to read that book. What part of the book, and this is obviously rhetorical, what part of the book was appropriate for a 15-year-old? Was it the fact that they basically became, on their own, social outcasts, which they created that for themselves. They insulated themselves from all the general population of the school because they didn't want to interact with them. So they made themselves their own, you know, pariah, so to speak. They studied a subject which the vast, vast majority of the population of the world doesn't understand, has no working knowledge of, and can't converse with you on or about. They commit a murder. They commit a second murder. They get heavily into drugs, into alcohol, homosexuality. There's incest, smoking, crack or cocaine, marijuana. What about that is appropriate for a 15-year-old? I'm 37, and I didn't identify with it at all, and I certainly wouldn't have identified with it if I'd read it when it was published when I was 18. But this person at 15, she understood that was a perfect age, and she says that everyone in her class was reading it. They were all walking around with it, and they were talking about who their favorite character was, and they talked about the logic of it, and all this stuff about who their favorite characters, and they talked about that as much as they talked about who their favorite bands were. I don't buy it. I don't buy it. And she says that at 14 years old, Richard and all these other characters were the characters that she had been waiting her whole life to meet. Her whole life of 14 years, the first three of which she was pissing in her own pants. I mean, she was waiting her whole life at 14. At 14 years old, my voice had barely changed. I was still shorter than my mother, who was 5'2". I still had braces on my teeth. And I had just, the year before, learned how to comb my hair. I didn't want to meet these people in the book. I don't want to meet them now. And yet at 14, she wanted to. I'd love to know where this girl grew up, that these characters were people that she wanted to meet, because I found no redeeming qualities about any of them. I didn't want to know them. I didn't want to meet them. Now, maybe it's the social outcast syndrome. Maybe it's the fact that I never really perceived myself as being a social outcast. Yeah, I wasn't the most popular guy in high school, but I wasn't the person who sits in the back corner of the classroom and hopes that nobody recognizes me. And I wasn't the one who, you know, was devoted to Morrissey and the Smiths and all that emo stuff. And maybe that's what she's saying. Maybe she's saying that's who she was. This is an emo chick who found a book that basically these main characters were emos from 30 years past. You know, the oh, woe is me, the, you know, we don't need the social conventions of society. We don't need to go to parties. We don't need to interact with popular people. We're going to turn our nose up at those people. Okay. And I saw a lot of this stuff in the articles that I read. I saw a lot of it. One of the articles I read was written in 1992. So it was written right at the time that the book came out. And this is what one of the beginning of the paragraph says, and this is from the New York Times. it says Henry, who is one of the main characters in that social that circle of students who committed the murder. Henry, the acknowledged leader of the group, is an amazingly wealthy and erudite autodidact, obsessed with obscure scholarship and given to dark judgmental moves. He is cold and manipulative, though capable of great harm. I don't know what an erudite autodidact is. And I understood the obsessed with obscure scholarship. That basically means I'm not going to study crap that everybody else is studying because I'm too good for that. This is like the people who claim that they don't like music once the band that they're a fan of sells out. Yeah, I used to go to punk rock shows, but when Rancid became real big, I stopped going. I don't like them anymore. Really? You like what you like and you don't like what you don't like. And being obsessed with obscure scholarship is basically a way of saying I'm a nonconformist. And that's fine. The world needs nonconformists. But I don't know if that's a reason to identify with a character, because that's just not who I am. It is a measure of Miss Tartt's complete assurance and skill as a writer that the shocking melodramatic events are made to seem plausible to the reader as well. So the writer of this article is saying that the writer, Miss Tartt, Donna Tartt, makes the murder seem reasonable. It could happen. It all makes sense. No. When does murder make sense? When does murder seem plausible? It doesn't. The problem with that concept is that it's the belief that that first murder that was committed was not a murder they could have gotten out of. And I'm not sure that that's really the case. We discussed it last time that I seem to recall there were two different perspectives on how the murder of the Vermont farmer took place. When Richard first finds out about it, he's told that it was an accident, that all these other characters, the other students, were under the influence of this Greek tradition, whatever it was. This non-sexual orgy is what I call it. And it was only after the murder had taken place that they realized that it had taken place. It was like, I'm walking through the woods and I'm under this daze and I'm, you know, kind of acting like a hippie with all the, you know, moody mood rings and stuff like that, and waving our arms and dancing around in circles. And the next thing I know, there's a guy lying dead in front of me. If that was the truth, there's a way out of it. You go back and you say, oh, you know what, we made a mistake, call out the cops, do whatever you do, you know, plead for, you know, clemency. I mean, as a moralist, that's the right thing that should have happened. Now, we later hear, if I recall correctly, a different turn of events, that actually the murder of the Vermont farmer was a considered effort on behalf of the students to basically see if they could get away with it. And if that's the case, then we've got a different situation. But if that's the case, then there's no way in hell that it's plausible to the reader. And nor is it plausible the killing of Bunny. And it may even be that this author of this article was focusing on the murder of Bunny as being plausible. That the only way we could have protected ourselves and saved ourselves was to kill our friend. I don't get that at all. I don't. I'm sorry. It says, because Miss Tartt's characters are all such chilly customers, they do not so much lose their innocence as make a sense of pragmatic, amoral decisions. Yes, I agree, and I don't identify with those people. As a result, real guilt and suffering do not occur in this novel. Yes, that's what I was looking for. I was looking for some sort of remorse. I was looking for some sort of a discovery by these characters that they'd done a bad thing. And none of them ever came to that discovery. I don't think at any time any of the characters, as they were going through their de-evolution, I don't think any of them ever said, hey, you know what? I think we made a mistake. We really didn't need to do that. It never came up. The reader is simply left with a group portrait of the banality of evil. Yeah, that's true. These people were evil. These were not, to quote the 15-year-old, people she'd been waiting her whole life to meet. These were evil people. These were just as evil as Manson and his followers, as the Night Stalker, as Ted Bundy, or, you know, Ted Kaczynski, whoever the Teds are. These were evil, evil people who never expressed remorse. So this is in 1992, after the book was written, a New York Times book reviewer who said, these people are the group portrait of the banality of evil. And yet in 2013, this other person says, these are the people I've been waiting my whole life to meet. Does that make any sense? It makes no sense to me. It makes no sense. He calls it, in New York Times, forceful, cerebral, and impeccably controlled, which is another way for saying real slow-paced. The secret history achieves just what Miss Tartt seems to have set out to do. It marches with cool, classical inevitability towards its terrible conclusion. Okay, I agree. But I like resolutions. I don't necessarily have to see a happy ending, but I don't like an ending that doesn't resolve things. And yes, one of the characters killed themselves. I don't really even remember why. It wasn't, as far as I could tell, out of remorse. It wasn't. I don't think he said, I'm sorry for what we did. I can't live with myself. Now, whether you're supposed to interpret that, I don't know. I really don't. Here's another review. And not to go into too much detail, it says, while some have decried her writing as that of someone who is just trying to show off her vast intellect, I found the book very thought-provoking and only mildly overwrought in certain areas. Yes, it was someone who was trying to show off her vast intellect. The first 100 pages of the book, which, if you didn't know that there was a murder committed, and that, I think, was the hook. I think it may have been the editor. I don't know. This would be an interesting concept. So Donna Tartt writes this book, and she starts with the first 100 pages, and it's all about the Greeks and the classics and Greek translation and Richard ingratiating himself into the select group of students who are with the Professor Julian and the discussions about whatever Greek philosophers and Greek writings and Greek literature. And the editor says, this is great. Where's it going? You're going to lose half of your readers because they're going to read this first 100 pages and go, who the hell cares? Where's this going? And so she said, oh, I got a great idea. I'll put on the first page there's a murder. So the readers will have to get through all this overwritten stuff, which proves how smart I am, in order to find out what the murder was. It's like a rite of passage. It's like, being told you have to eat your vegetables in order to get dessert. The readers will be hooked by the first page where I tell them there's a murder, and then I'm going to spend 100 pages telling them how smart I am, which they're going to have to read because they're going to want to know about the murder. The murder is the juicy part. I've talked about it before. No book would be interesting without the villain. There's always got to be a villain. I read a book, I tried to read a book, a couple weeks ago, I got 100 pages in, called Instruments of Darkness by Imogen something or other. And it was one of these Victorian mysteries, and I thought it was along the lines of the books that I've enjoyed reading lately. And I got 100 pages into this 350-page book. And even though there had been a murder, the actual villain had not shown up. And it's the villain that drives the story. Now, I know in The Secret History that there's no real villain, because he tells you it's him. Richard tells you not only that Bunny's dead on the first page, but he tells you that that he had something to do with it. Now, you don't know whether to believe he's a villain or not. You don't know whether he's going to try and explain to you why it was done and try and come up with some rationale as to why it was justified. But there's no villain. Even the murder itself wasn't particularly compelling. It was just kind of done. And I understand, this book is not a thriller. It's not a novel of suspense. It's literary fiction. It's called a novel. And even though it says it's compelling and elegant and dramatic and playful, it's a modern classic. I'm reading off the back of the book. One of the reviews says it's absolutely chilling. No. Beautifully written, Vogue magazine, beautifully written, suspenseful from start to finish. No. The suspense was, how long are we going to have to read all this stuff that shows how smart you are until we get to the real juicy parts? And the juicy parts were few and far between. Here's an article from The Guardian magazine, written in 2013 in anticipation of the publication of The Goldfinch, Donna Tartt's latest book. And he writes 10 reasons why we love Donna Tartt's Secret History. I thought this would be the perfect article because it would give me all the reasons why I should have enjoyed the book more than I did. And I'm not going to go through all 10 of them, but he says here, number one, it starts with a murder. The novelist's first trick is also Donna Tartt's best. In the prologue, her narrator, Richard, tells us of the murder of Bunny. He appears to have got away with it and yet to be haunted by it. I didn't see that at all. I spent the whole book wondering why he was telling us this story. And I mentioned it before. Was he telling us this story because he wanted to unburden himself? Because he felt finally he'd come to his senses and realized they'd done a bad thing and he was expressing remorse? I didn't know whether he was telling us the story because he'd finally gotten caught and he was turning state's evidence, basically testifying against his cohorts. I didn't know why he was telling us this story. And yet this guy seems to think he got it. Richard got away with it and he's haunted by it. I didn't get that at all. I didn't see that at all. The second reason why we should love Donna Tartt's Secret History, because it is in love with ancient Greece. Donna Tartt proves the truth of what literary parents piously tell their children. Nothing can beat the Greek myths. Well, that shows how ignorant I am. Because the Greek myths I studied, I don't even remember whether they were Greek. I think they were. Isn't that, Odysseus and the Sirens and Perseus or the whatever it was, the Iliad, the Odyssey, all that kind of stuff? Is that really the Greek myths that this book is in love with? Because I didn't get that at all. But maybe my ninth grade English literature, no, it couldn't have been English literature, maybe seventh grade literature class, seventh grade English class, maybe we didn't study that stuff enough. Or maybe when I got to college, I took real classes. I took practical classes. It says here, number nine, reason why we love the Donna Tartt's Secret History, it is possessed with Dionysos, Dionysos. I have no clue who that is. And if you know who that is, then it's clear that most of us were studying something useful while you were studying this stuff. The only thing that I can determine, and I'm cynical, I admit it, I'm cynical, you can call me on it. The only reason to study Greek literature is to either teach it or write about it. It's not going to help you become an accountant or an attorney or a doctor. And if what you want to do is become a Greek professor, by all means, study it. If you want to become a writer, by all means, study it. But does the vast majority of the students actually get this? No, they're not taking those classes. Reason number four, it has a classic lonely narrator. Richard is perfectly prepared to be entranced. He is friendless and frustrated without family support or sympathy. He arrives at university to look for a better life, especially a better life in his spirit. Yeah, he's Holden Caulfield. He's the loner. He's the guy who sits in the back of the classroom all by himself, listens to Morrissey, listens to the Smiths, and goes home and figures out how to draw "I love Morrissey" on his notebook. That's not me. And that's not the vast majority of people. You know who that is, unfortunately. Those are the people who commit murders. What these guys did, and it just occurred to me, what these people in these articles are glamorizing about the secret history, how different is that from what happens at Columbine or the shooters that go into the schools? And I'm not in any way trying to diminish the impact or the evil of what those people did. But how different is it from what happened in the secret history? those people allegedly were influenced by the music they listened to, by the books that they read, by the websites that they surfed. In the secret history, they're influenced by the books that they read, the classics that they studied. How is that different? Why is it okay to glorify and glamorize what the characters did in the secret history when it's no different? Where the difference is because they're not listening to heavy thrash metal and satanic worshiping music, but they're studying the higher education of Greek literature and Greek mythology and the Greek classics. It's supposed to give them a pass. I don't know. I honestly haven't thought about that. It really just came to me as we're talking about it, this idea that it's got this classic lonely narrator. I mean, there's something to conformity. And I'm not saying that conformity is the optimal, because with conformity there's no independence and individuality. I get that. But it's not an either or. It's not conformity or loner status. It's not conformity or outcast. It's not one or the other. You can do both. You can have your independence, and then you can be conformist. Pick your battles. I don't know. Number 10, it lets you in on secrets. Every one of the millions who have read The Secret History has the delicious illusion of being admitted to the most dangerous of confidences. It is as if her every reader is the first and only one to read it. Now, I don't know. It meant nothing to me. So, that's it. Did I miss something? Maybe. Are all these people posers? I can't imagine. I'm cynical. I call them posers because if I don't understand them, I call them names. That's what a lot of people do. We mock what we don't understand, and I didn't understand it. So, anyways, on to new and better and other stuff. I'm not going to read any more of her books. Sorry. I don't have the time to invest. I don't want to go through that. I just don't. I read some really good stuff lately. We'll talk about it next time. I'm reading a book right now, which I'll tie into a classic that I read that I really enjoyed, but we'll talk about that next time. This is Rob Cohen for Book Therapy, and thank you for letting me lie on your couch.